Welcome. You are listening to the UC Davis Center of Poverty Research Seminar Series. I'm the Center's Deputy Director, Marianne Page. This series brings scholars and policy experts from around the country to discuss their work on poverty and poverty research. In December 2013, the Center co-hosted Peter Gianneros with the UC Davis Center for Mind and Brain. Gianneros is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Pittsburgh, where he and his colleagues use neuroimaging to understand the links between stressful experiences and risk for cardiovascular disease. Here is Gianneros presenting his seminar, Neurobiology of Socioeconomic Health Disparities.
It really is an honor to be here. Part of what I've been trying to do over the last few years is get social scientists who are interested in disparities research to be more interested in the brain and what neuroscience has to offer. And part of what I've been trying to do is get neuroscientists more interested in socioeconomic health disparities. So for me to be able to speak essentially to two audiences with shared interests, you know, at the interface of what I've been trying to do is something I've never had the experience to do before. So I'm very grateful to be here. Okay, so as Paul mentioned, today I'm going to be talking a little bit about some ideas and questions and some findings from a program of research that I started a little over 5 years ago, where the interest has been to try to better understand some of the neurobiology of socioeconomic health disparities with a particular focus on heart disease, atherosclerotic heart disease, which is still the leading cause of death among men and women and adults in this country and other developed nations. So to do this, what I've done is I've organized today's talk around five themes. So what I hope to do is just spend a few minutes talking a little bit about the broader context that has contributed and kind of fostered some of the questions that we've been asking. Then I'd like to talk a little bit, kind of make a plug for neuroscience and what I think neuroscience might have to offer in the way of kind of understanding the neurobiology of health disparities. Then I'll kind of switch gears a little bit and talk about some of the conceptual issues that we've been struggling with, in trying to apply neuroscience methodologies to understand these health disparities. Then I'll move on to talking a little bit about some findings from our own work, particularly what we've been up to recently. And then finally, I'll talk a little bit about where I hope to see things going in the future, not only in our own work, but also in trying to figure out what we can do to get more people talking to each other about these issues. I should say, I'm perfectly happy with fielding questions along the way. I know that I'm speaking to two audiences. So I know, we have one group of people in here where neuroscience and neuroscience methods might be a little foreign. So if I'm slipping into jargon or something doesn't make sense, feel free to, raise your hand. I'm fine to field questions. And then we have another audience of neuroscientists and psychologists who might not be used to thinking about disparities. So there'll be plenty of opportunities for me to oversimplify things and make a fool of myself. So, I'm happy to field questions and along the way. So as Paul mentioned, I am a psychophysiologist by training. And for about the last 13 years, I've been doing brain imaging research and neuroscience research that's aimed at understanding how stress-related processes instantiated in the brain relate to risk for atherosclerotic heart disease, particularly in two lines of research. So in one line of this research, we've been using functional magnetic resonance imaging and functional imaging methodologies to characterize some of the brain circuits and brain systems that are involved in generating acute changes in cardiovascular activity. So like rises in your blood pressure and rises in your heart rate during acute stressful experiences. So the questions here are like, what are the brain mechanisms that generate these acute stress responses? The reason that we're interested in this particular kind of question is because these acute changes in cardiovascular activity, so acute surges in blood pressure, when you're angry or when you're stressed out, the magnitude of those changes actually predict your risk for developing hypertension in the future and developing coronary heart disease, having a stroke or a heart attack. So in that way, what we're trying to do essentially is understand the brain systems that link stressful experiences to a person's stress-related risk for heart disease. In another line of this research, we've been using structural imaging methods. So here, we're not looking at brain function, we're looking at brain structure. And the goal is to characterize aspects of brain morphology. So for example, like tissue volume, the integrity of white matter tracts that connect different parts of the brain. So we're characterizing these aspects of morphology, and we're relating them to more chronic stressful experiences. So things that don't happen, you know, on a moment-to-moment basis, but things that you might endure for years. And we're also looking at aspects of brain morphology in relation to biological and behavioral risk factors for heart disease, such as systemic inflammation, hypertension, adiposity, and obesity. And I'll talk a little bit more about how these lines of research kind of led to where we're at right now, and how we're still using these approaches, particularly in the context of socioeconomic health disparities. Okay, so my favorite slides. With respect to the first line of research, the goal, again, has been to kind of characterize neural circuits that are involved in centrally generating changes in the outflow of autonomic nervous system activity to peripheral target organs, particularly your heart and your vasculature, that lead to changes in blood pressure and heart rate and the redistribution of blood to different organs that in the short term might be adaptive, in that they promote, you know, things like the fight or flight response, which some of you might be familiar with. And in the short term, these kinds of cardiovascular changes can be adaptive. They facilitate behavioral actions that might promote survival. But again, as I mentioned earlier, if you're someone who's prone to showing exaggerated rises in blood pressure or heart rate, and you show these repeatedly over time, there's evidence to suggest that these kinds of cardiovascular changes cumulatively over time can either initiate or exacerbate damage to the cardiovascular system that might promote or accelerate or exacerbate some of the inflammatory events that lead to an accelerated progression of atherosclerosis over time, which is the major disease process that contributes to like late-stage events such as myocardial infarctions that can be fatal or non-fatal. And in this line of research, what we've been trying to do essentially is better characterize some of the circuitries. We don't have to get into the details of this, but I'm happy to talk about this work a little bit later. But essentially what we'll be trying to do is identify neural correlates of acute changes in blood pressure and cardiovascular activity during imaging protocols. So, you know, we put people in an MRI machine, we have them do stressful tasks, we monitor their blood pressure and their heart rate, we look at their brain activity, and then we identify areas where, you know, brain signal changes relate to the magnitude of the stress response. And we focus on a couple of areas in particular because these are areas that are involved not only in processing stressful information, but also regulating peripheral physiology through their projections to midbrain and brainstem areas that regulate autonomic nervous system outflow to the periphery. And in work that we're trying to do now, we're trying to predict the multi-year progression, longitudinal progression of atherosclerosis based on MR signal changes that we can evoke in the scanner with our stressor tasks. So that's kind of one line of my research and, you know, one focus of my research. So, in addition to trying to understand some of the neural correlates of acute stress reactivity, another line of research that I mentioned earlier is interested more in kind of like bottom-up questions. So, for example, how do risk factors for heart disease, such as obesity and adiposity, hypertension, and then markers of systemic inflammation, how do they relate to the morphology of particular brain areas that are involved in mediating a diverse range of cognitive and emotional processes? And there's a lot of evidence accumulating to suggest that these kinds of indicators of chronic health can come to impact the brain through bottom-up pathways that involve the influence of pro-inflammatory cytokines and markers of systemic inflammation that can come to be cytotoxic, can result in remodeling of brain areas. Hypertension can have effects, adverse effects on the brain as well. And so a lot of the work here is kind of more focused on these kind of chronic influences on brain function and structure. Any questions so far? Okay. All right. So all the while that I've been doing this imaging research on cardiovascular disease, I've been perfectly happy to ignore, the elephant in the room that, again, I think half the audience is very well familiar with. And this elephant is the fact that chronic illnesses like coronary heart disease, mortality by chronic illnesses, and even risk factors for chronic illnesses like heart disease, they're not randomly distributed in the population. All of these things track a socioeconomic gradient. And we've known about this for decades, and as well, as I mentioned, some of you are very very familiar with this. There are huge disparities in chronic illnesses, particularly heart disease. The Black Report in the UK put this, I think, squarely on the map, and led to a whole field of research concerned with socioeconomic health disparities. And what I'm going to be talking about for the rest of today's presentation is essentially what I consider to be an oversight on the part of neuroscience in terms of maybe not appreciating these existing disparities and kind of paying attention to what neuroscience might be able to offer this field and what the field of disparities research might be able to offer to neuroscience. So this slide is kind of for the other part of the audience. This is a typical example of a replicated finding that's been shown in a number of countries, but this is kind of what the nature of the relationship is that I'm broadly referring to. So this is the relative risk of premature death plotted as a function of family income in the United States, where premature death is age and sex-adjusted relative risk of dying before the age of 65 for any cause. And what you can see is a clear gradient such that the relative risk of dying prematurely increases as a function of lower levels of family income, and the relative risk of premature death declines as a function of increasing family income. You see relationships like this with other indicators of socioeconomic status that I'll talk about a little bit later, such as educational attainment and so forth. And you can measure this in multiple ways at multiple levels of analysis. But it's not only true for indicators, heart health indicators such as premature mortality, but there are disparities that track a socioeconomic gradient for leading chronic illnesses, particularly chronic illnesses that pose the greatest burdens to public health right now, with coronary artery disease being at the top, stroke, functional GI disorders, arthritis, chronic bronchitis and obstructive pulmonary disease, asthma and type 2 diabetes. All these chronic illnesses track a socioeconomic gradient. And then what's even more interesting, I think, for me is that even the non-random clustering of multiple chronic illnesses tracks a socioeconomic gradient. So what we're looking at here are prevalence rates of having two or more of nine chronic illnesses, including hypertension, coronary heart disease, diabetes, some forms of cancer, stroke, bronchitis, emphysema, asthma, and kidney disease. So having two or more of these diseases, the probability, the prevalence rate of having two or more of these illnesses increases the further below the poverty line you go. And so the green bars here indicate prevalence rates from 1999 to 2000 and 2009 to 2010. So what you can see is over this kind of 10-year period, overall there's an increase in having two or more chronic illnesses. But again, you see kind of gradients existing for the non-random clustering. So in a sense, it's indicators of socioeconomic disadvantage can be taken as kind of indicators of flypaper, essentially, for having multiple chronic illnesses. And as I mentioned earlier, it's not only chronic illnesses, but it's risk factors for chronic illnesses that also track a socioeconomic gradient. And this exists for multiple risk factors, many of which I'm interested in because they're known to predict contribute to risk for heart disease. So high blood pressure, hypertension, glucose dysregulation, markers of systemic inflammation that I'll talk a lot more about a little bit later, cigarette smoking, physical activity, sedentary lifestyle, dyslipidemia, overweight, all of these track socioeconomic gradient. And as I mentioned earlier, so we've known about these disparities and we've known about these gradients in health and risk factors for poor health for many decades, and this has primarily been the focus and interest of economists, sociologists, health psychologists, social epidemiologists. But for the most part, these disparities have kind of been relatively ignored by neuroscientists, cognitive neuroscientists, social neuroscientists. And I think that's an important oversight for reasons that I'll elaborate on next. So what I want to do now is just talk a little bit about where I see neuroscience fitting into this this area of research. So I should say it isn't entirely fair to say that neuroscience has not been interested in disparities. This is not true at all. There's been an emerging growing interest on the part of neuroscientists in disparities that exist in terms of cognitive function that emerge early. And I know a lot of that work is being done here, and there's a lot of interest here on campus. So for example, it's well known that disparities exist in executive functions, working memory, fairly early in life, and these track a socioeconomic gradient, and they predict very important things like academic achievement and attainment later in life. And again, there's kind of growing interest on the role of the brain in kind of linking indicators of disadvantage to these kind of early cognitive disparities. But at the same time, people like me who are interested in physical health and doing neuroscience research on physical health, I can honestly stand up here and say that there's little to no interest outside of like what we've been trying to do in understanding the connections between socioeconomic disparities, brain function, and brain structure, and how they relate to chronic illnesses that represent major public health problems today. So, if I'm saying that this is an oversight, are there any reasons to care? So what that neuroscience hasn't been doing work on physical health? Why is that important? Well, one reason why I think it's important, like why neuroscientists I think should care, is that there's a growing body of evidence in the field of like neuroepidemiology, for example, showing that things like adiposity, physical inactivity, indicators of heart disease, markers of systemic inflammation, which Time magazine is not the silent killer. It's actually, some people might think that, I don't know. But this was a Time magazine issue on systemic inflammation. But there's a lot of work in neuroepidemiology showing that like all of these risk factors and all these chronic health conditions relate to adverse changes in brain function and brain structure. And the goal in this work in neuroepidemiology is to really kind of follow up on this long-standing body of evidence showing that chronic illnesses predict premature cognitive decline. For example, risk factors for heart disease predict later risk for dementia. And the goal there in neuroepidemiology is to kind of understand the neural pathways linking these risk factors for chronic illness and chronic illnesses to later life cognitive decline. But as I mentioned earlier, these risk factors and these chronic illnesses, they all track a socioeconomic gradient. So I think even in this field of neuroepidemiology, I don't think you're going to have a complete ideological understanding of how these can kind of come to influence brain and then later life dementia and risk unless you fully account for the social patterning of these risk factors and these health conditions. So I think it helps in terms of building your ideological understanding of basic pathways that you're interested in by accounting for known disparities as well. Broad category of reasons why I think neuroscientists should care is that many of the social processes and cognitive processes, affective, behavioral, even visceral control processes that I'm interested in a lot of these processes track a socioeconomic gradient, and then also at the same time, from the perspective of sociology and epidemiology, and even like behavioral economics, a lot of these processes that neuroscientists are interested in are considered as mediators in between socioeconomic disadvantage and health behaviors, and even risk factors that are known to track a socioeconomic gradient. So I think in this way, neuroscientists has a lot of room to contribute to informing epidemiological models of disease risk that are prevalent in health disparities research. So I think that there are rich opportunities to do cross-disciplinary work in this area. Any questions? Pretty straightforward. Okay. All right. So it's in this context that we've been doing work in this area, and we've been doing functional imaging work and structural imaging work with the goal of trying to understand the role of the brain in linking socioeconomic disparities to these disparities in chronic illnesses and risk factors. So what I'd like to do now is just say a few words about some conceptual issues that we've been struggling with, particularly like definitional issues, as we've kind of like built up this program of work, and then after this I'll start talking about how we've been trying to integrate some of these conceptual issues with some work that we've been doing. So this is more for the neuroscience audience as we kind of move forward. In doing this work, we take the kind of the definitional approach that socioeconomic status is a multidimensional construct, and it's also a multi-level construct. In general, how we think about socioeconomic status is that it refers to a person's relative standing in some social hierarchy or social position in some social hierarchy. And that this standing is closely linked to access to physical, social, material resources, and also life opportunities. So this is kind of like our broad kind of conceptual approach to defining how we go about measuring and thinking about SES. SES is multidimensional in the sense that it can be measured along dimensions of educational attainment over the life course. It can be measured from a financial dimension, where you're measuring things like family income, personal income, and so forth, occupational prestige, occupational status. And the measures that we use and that other people use in this field of research, these can be subjective or objective. So they can be subjective in the sense that you can use measures, for example, like the MacArthur scale of subjective socioeconomic status, where you give someone a visual ladder and you say something like the people at the top of the ladder are the best off in society, they have the best jobs, the best incomes, the highest levels of education, and the people at the bottom are the worst off. They have the worst jobs, worst educations, little to no income, and so forth. And then you just ask people to say, where would you rank yourself in relation to other people, like on this ladder? It's a very subjective scale. It correlates somewhat, but not very highly, with objective measures. But interestingly, these subjective measures predict hard health outcomes and health status. And we've used some of those in our research as well. And then, as you can imagine, these measures can be objective in the sense that you can ask someone, how many years of schooling have you completed? What was your highest degree earned? Fairly objective indicators. All these measures are correlated with each other, sometimes more strongly in some populations than others, but they're certainly not redundant and they're not interchangeable. So it's not like socioeconomic status is like one thing and you can just like average all these things together. I think you're obscuring a lot of important conceptual information when you do something like that, I think, as other people have argued fairly convincingly. But also from my perspective, something important to keep in mind is that all these dimensions and all these indicators of socioeconomic status can relate to health through very different pathways, right? So if you trace a pathway from income to coronary heart disease, the mediating factors might be very different than if you're looking at something like education, for example, and then the intermediate factors that might link to something like heart disease. So multidimensional in this sense. Socioeconomic status is also something that's multi-level. Okay, so you can take indicators of socioeconomic status and measure them at the individual or person level. You can measure them at the level of the household, at the level of the neighborhood, which is something that I've been focusing on actually more and more recently over the last year or so. And you can do this by taking a person's street address and then looking at information that might be available based on census databases or publicly available databases, and looking at, you know, median household income on that block, percentage of people who are unemployed, percentage of people on public assistance, and then, you know, measuring SES at this level of analysis. And then you can go beyond the neighborhood. You can go to counties, you can go to states, and higher social assemblies as well. So it's multi-level in this sense. And so I guess in thinking about this multi-level and then multi-dimensional beast of a variable, what we've been trying to do essentially is relate these kind of different indicators of socioeconomic status to aspects of brain function and brain structure in an attempt to kind of understand some of the different neurobiological pathways that might link risk factors for chronic illnesses spanning multiple levels of analysis to health across the life course. And we've only really kind of scratched the surface on a lot of the questions you know, that you might be able to ask in this line of research. And we've been trying to do it in multiple ways. But I think this, you can probably come up with all kinds of complicated figures, and this isn't the best one, but I think this is kind of where we're at this point. And this is where I kind of see a figure as something that might be kind of capturing the different disciplinary approaches where, you know, neuroscientists and people who are interested in disparities can kind of come together and start filling in different parts of the cubes and asking questions in different search spaces within this area. Okay. So time is flying. So what I'd like to do now is talk a little bit about just some example findings from a recent study that we did. And again, if there are questions that come up as I go along, I'm happy to talk about this. And I also have a total of like 100 slides. So I'm not going to go through all of them, but if I get through this one and some of you guys are interested in the functional work that we do, I have lots of backup slides that I can talk about, like other studies that we've done during the question and answer period. Okay. So as I mentioned earlier, I don't know why that just happened. I think I did something on the plane that I didn't mean to. Anyway, so as I mentioned earlier, one of my areas of interest is in understanding how risk factors for coronary heart disease, particularly in biological and behavioral measures of systemic inflammation, might play a role in linking heart disease risk with aspects of brain morphology that might in turn relate to aspects of cognitive functioning and emotional functioning across the life course. So, for example, in studies that we've done before, my colleagues and I have shown that markers of systemic inflammation, such as things you might have heard of before, like C-reactive protein, interleukin-6, indicators of like pro-inflammatory states, we've shown that those relate to decreased integrity of white matter tracts in the brain. We've shown that markers of systemic inflammation relate to reduced cerebral blood flow. And we've also shown that they relate to markers of cortical atrophy and regional brain tissue volume declines. We've shown the same thing for markers of hypertension. So we've related hypertension to reduced white matter, reduced cerebral blood flow, brain atrophy. And I'm doing more work with my colleagues at Pitt on adiposity and obesity and trying to understand some of the neural correlates and kind of possible some adverse, you know, neural consequences of obese states. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that all of these risk factors and indicators are related to altered cognition and altered emotional functioning, and so the goal here is to try to understand some of the neural pathways that link these risk factors to altered states of cognition and behavior. I also wanted to say here that, again, going back to a point that I made earlier, is that like all of these health conditions and risk factors are known to track a socioeconomic gradient as well. So we have a good base of evidence suggesting that they're related to brain function and brain morphology, and we have a separate body of evidence suggesting that they track a socioeconomic gradient. So as an example of, you know, one study that we've done in this area, we've asked the question of whether coronary heart disease risk factors that are known to track a socioeconomic gradient link indicators of socioeconomic inequalities to the structural integrity of brain networks. This is a study we published earlier this year. So more specifically in this study, we asked whether in conceptualizing SES as a multidimensional construct, we asked whether different multi-level indicators of SES relate to the integrity of white matter tracts in the brain. And then if so, so essentially, like, is there a main effect? Is there a relationship between indicators of SES and white matter integrity? And then if there is this kind of relationship, what are the possible mediating factors? So here we turn to behavioral and biological risk factors for coronary heart disease, particularly those that are known to be associated with systemic inflammation. We asked whether these play a mediating role, whether they serve as mediators. So to address these questions, we used available measures from a study that I've been conducting since 2008. So this is Pennsylvania. This is my county, Allegheny County. And then this is Allegheny County blown up. And these are all the different census tracts. And so what I did in the study is we sent out randomized mass mailings to residents of census tracts in Allegheny County to try to get a representative socioeconomic distribution. The initial wave of data collection was from 2008 to 2011, and we've been funded up through the end of 2016 to do longitudinal work. So essentially, my goal is to try to track the progression of a preclinical atherosclerosis and try to predict this progression based on a lot of stress-related indicators of brain function and stress physiology. But we do a comprehensive kind of socioeconomic status assessment in all the participants who come through, so we're able to ask questions with respect to, you know, social disparities as well. This is called the Pittsburgh Imaging Project, or PIP for short. It was my first R01, and I had great expectations, so I called it PIP. It's true. It's very difficult. So as part of PIP, the subjects complete like a multi-part protocol. They complete a lot of psychosocial inventories, so we get at, you know, socioeconomic status, life events, personality, and so forth. They give a lot of blood. We take a lot of blood, and that's because, you know, we're looking at standard cardiovascular risk factors like lipid levels, pro-inflammatory cytokines, you name it, fatty acids, antioxidants, a lot of blood. They also complete a carotid artery ultrasound imaging protocol. So this is a non-invasive way to measure the severity and extent of preclinical atherosclerosis in the carotid arteries. So in this way, this is what we're doing kind of repeatedly over time to kind of track the progression of atherosclerosis as well. And then finally, they complete a fairly long battery of functional imaging tasks, a lot of which are meant to induce an acute stressful state. And then we do a lot of structural imaging as well to look at regional brain tissue volume and white matter tract integrity as well. I should say a couple of other things that are important to keep in mind about this sample. All of them are unmedicated, so we want the healthiest people possible to rule out a lot of confounds of disease causing, you know, something first and medication status. So all of them are unmedicated. None of them have any history of heart disease, so none of them have ever been diagnosed with hypertension. They've never had a heart attack, never had a stroke. They go through psychiatric screening, so none of them have a confounding psychiatric disorder. We have a fairly okay African-American representation in the sample, even though Allegheny County is predominantly Caucasian. About 23% of the participants in PIP are African-American. And then I'll provide, as I mentioned earlier, they provide blood and they complete a lot of psychosocial inventories as well. Yes, question.
Peter, given what you were saying about the non-random distribution of cardiovascular risk factors, et cetera, this incredibly healthy group of participants from a representative distribution of Allegheny County, including the impoverished census district, aren't you potentially pulling for people who are extremely, either genetically or behaviorally resilient against early signs of cardiovascular disease because they're up to 50 years old and they haven't shown signs yet?
Yeah, I would say yes and no. So I definitely believe that we are excluding people well below the poverty line. So in that sense, I think in terms of screening, we don't have a truly disadvantaged, I think, group of people represented. So I think that there are some threshold issues. At the same time, the people who end up getting into the study tend to be relatively well educated. And of higher SES, probably because they've had opportunities to engage in health behaviors and so forth. The other side to my argument, though, kind of countering this, is that you still see gradients across the SES spectrum. So we have a lot of people who never completed high school and are kind of well below the poverty line. And then we do have some people in there. Who are very well above the poverty line and, were principals of schools and have, our MDs and so forth. So we're still able to see, linear trends, but probably at the extremes of the distribution, we're losing a lot of those kinds of people. So our inferences, I would say, are limited in that respect. Yeah, good question.
You mentioned that Allegheny County is predominantly Caucasian, but you wanted to account for diversity in your study. Did you happen to include socioeconomic gradients within each racial category?
So. Yes and no. So it's not a large sample. So this is 155 people. And also for unfortunate reasons, Allegheny County is still fairly residentially segregated. Mm-hmm. So at the neighborhood level, poverty and race are still confounded in many respects, and we don't have the power to look at within neighborhood or within ethnicity gradients. Oftentimes what we do to try to account for that is to see whether the effects still hold only if you analyze the Caucasian the Caucasians in the sample. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Good questions. Okay, so the main measure that we were interested in here is a measure of an indirect indicator of white matter integrity. So for those of you, this is for the one part of the audience, the economists and so forth in the group, we're using diffusion tensor imaging, which is a kind of structural imaging approach that quantifies the direction that water molecules go or flow in the brain. And DTI provides some indicators of the structural connectivity of white matter tracks that connect different parts of the brain. And I'll explain a little bit more of this in the next slide. But the most common measure of tract integrity, again, in quotes, is this measure called fractional anisotropy. So imagine these as water molecules in the brain. If water molecules in a particular part of the brain or in a particular voxel or volume element, which is basically space in the brain that you can image, if water molecules are going in all different directions, it means that there are not a lot of structural boundaries or structural integrity like neurofilaments and axons and myelin to prevent them from going in all different directions. And as water molecules start to flow more uniformly in one direction, that means that there are a lot of intact kind of structural barriers preventing them from flowing in all different directions and kind of keeps them going in one direction. So a low FA value, a value of zero, would mean that water molecules are just randomly kind of diffusing in all different directions. And then a high FA value, a value of one, would mean that the integrity of these white matter tracks is relatively strong. And there's some animal evidence showing that like myelin damage and so forth kind of reduces FA values, and you can have some degree of confidence that these indicators provide kind of diffuse or gross indicators of white matter tract integrity. And I should say, a point I'll return to a little bit later, is that all of the risk factors that I've been talking about earlier, like smoking, adiposity, systemic inflammation, these have all been related in neuroepidemiological studies with reduced tract integrity before. So this is kind of one reason why we were interested in using diffusion tensor imaging in this study. Our SES indicators, we looked at education. Here we're using years of schooling. As I mentioned earlier, this is a fairly well-educated sample. So most people completed about 17 years of school, with the range being 11 to 24, so still a fairly good range. We looked at income as well. So we did annual household income adjusted for the number of occupants. The median was, median bracket was 50 to 65K. With the range being less than $10,000 a year, so well below the poverty line for a lot of participants, and then above $185 for some participants as well. And then again, as I mentioned earlier, I'm becoming fascinated by what you can do with geocoding and geographical information analysis. But this was kind of one of the first expeditions into doing kind of higher level SES assessments. But what we did is we used geocoding to look at census tract information about the median household income in the census tract, where we were drawing our people from percentage of people on public assistance, percentage of people below the poverty line, percent unemployed, and then the percent without a high school diploma. I think, as most of you guys know, if you do a factor analysis, you get one score. You know, it all loads on to essentially like a deprivation factor. So these were the SES variables that we were using. In terms of the mediators, what we looked at smoking status. So a lot of the participants were never smokers. Some were former smokers, and then some were current smokers. We looked at waist circumference as a measure of relative adiposity. About half the sample was obese, with a pretty standard range that you see in community samples in terms of waist circumference. And then as our marker of systemic inflammation, we looked at C-reactive protein. A lot of you are familiar with this. It's a unique and very robust predictor of heart disease, and it contributes to kind of the independent prediction of myocardial infarction and stroke, aside from standard risk factors. All of these factors, for the most part, are strongly interrelated with one another. And smoking and waist circumference are thought to be kind of inflammatory states, or things that can contribute to systemic inflammation as well. In terms of results, as you can imagine, our indicators of SES were fairly intercorrelated with each other. So education correlated fairly strongly with income, a little bit less with community SES. And then income, as you could imagine, was fairly related, fairly strongly related to community SES. In terms of correlations between socioeconomic status and our risk factors, we see what a lot of other people see. So smoking was inversely related to education, income, and community SES. Waist circumference was negatively related, and marginally for income, but negatively related to our indicators of SES. And then C-reactive protein, as other people have shown, it was inversely related to all of our indicators of SES. In our analyses, we used a toolbox that I was involved in developing with Tim Versteinen at Penn State. But this is an open source toolbox that any of you on the neuroscience side, if you guys are interested in this, it allows you to do mediation testing on a voxel-wise basis with your imaging data. And it uses the Preacher and Hayes approach. And we're extending it now to allow you to do more kind of sophisticated path analyses as well. So in using the Bravo toolbox, here's what we found. These are cross-sectional voxel-wise mediation maps. So what we're doing is we're looking at the indirect effects of education, income, and community SES on fractionally anisotropy as mediated by smoking status and adiposity. So smoking, if you can see, is kind of in red. Adiposity is in blue, and then this kind of magenta color is where they kind of overlap together. And there are a couple of take-home messages here. One is every single indicator, so education, income, and community SES, all of those were positively related to white matter integrity. So the higher your SES on every one of these scales, the higher your white matter tract integrity. Okay, and conversely, like the lower your SES, the less the white matter integrity. Both smoking and adiposity served as statistical mediators of these effects. So essentially, like lower SES was related to lower white matter integrity through smoking and through adiposity. Okay, so as mediated by those. And then there were some areas where there was an overlap in these mediated effects. So if you do like for the neuroscientists, like a conjunction analysis, there were some parts of the white matter tracts where these effects converged. We looked at these all in independent analyses. When you put them kind of all in the same model, you get a lot of competition and multicollinearity here. So I can't make any inferences about directionality because these are cross-sectional data, and I don't know, you know, who's the strongest predictor yet because we don't have enough power to do, you know, proper multi-level modeling. But each of these indicators was related to white matter integrity, and they were mediated by these factors. This is kind of a breaking it down and not getting too bogged down into the details, which I'm happy to go into. I have backup slides. But when we looked at relative effect sizes, the thickness of these arrows is coded essentially by the percentage of voxels showing these mediated effects. And it appeared that smoking a status had, there were a greater percentage of voxels showing mediation by smoking status to FA than there were for waist circumference per se. And this is when you put both smoking and waist circumference in the same model. What was even more interesting is in kind of path analyses, it was C-reactive protein that was statistically accounting for the effects of smoking on FA and waist circumference on FA in these white matter areas that were showing mediated effects by all these SES indicators. So essentially what we've done is we've kind of established at least a cross-sectional pathway that goes from like SES to adiposity and smoking to C-reactive protein to fractional anisotropy or white matter integrity. So I think these are interesting to me because, as I mentioned earlier, we know risk factors. So just to take one example, like smoking status, there are lots and lots of studies showing that smoking status tracks a socioeconomic, you know, gradient. And you can do this with education, you can do this with income. These things emerge kind of fairly early in life and persist. But I think with the study I just showed you, it kind of adds a neural component to this. So what might be the consequences or neural correlates of gradients like this? And, you know, where does the brain stand in these risk factors? So just kind of an example of the work that we're doing. I know I'm kind of running out of time here. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about some of the next steps and then open it up for questions. So I just want to conclude by raising some questions and then talking about where I hope to see things going. So why care on the part of neuroscience? I think that it's important to care because chronic illnesses, as I mentioned, neuroepidemiology has shown this, chronic illnesses and risk factors for chronic illnesses might have a negative impact on brain circuits. And we know that these chronic illnesses are socially patterned. So I think, you know, to have a complete ideological understanding of things that neuroscientists and neuroepidemiologists might be interested in, I think it's important to account for this social patterning. And the same thing goes, I just kind of mentioned this, but even the risk factors like smoking status, adiposity, systemic inflammation, those might have an impact on brain circuits, and we know that those risk factors are socially patterned. A lot of the processes and outcomes that neuroscientists, social neuroscientists, affective neuroscientists, cognitive neuroscientists, a lot of the processes and outcomes that are of interest exhibit disparities as well, and I think it's important to kind of keep these in mind when doing work. From a developmental and life course perspective, a lot of these associations emerge early in life. They persist late into life. So I think from a developmental and life course perspective, it's also important to keep these disparities in mind. And then also at a very basic level, you know, as a neuroscientist, I think accounting for disparities has implications for subject selection, generalizability of your findings, and even, you know, intervention work that's being done in affective neuroscience and, you know, psychiatric and imaging work, psychiatric neuroscience work. And I think there's a point I made earlier is I think neuroscientists, you know, have opportunities to create, you know, to help build up models to understand a major social problem as well. Why care on the part of disparities, you know, scientists? So why might sociologists and economists and health psychologists care? Well, risk factors emerge from the brain, you know, so something like smoking status. There are brain circuits that contribute to habit formation and, you know, determine the appetitive value of cigarettes and things. So a lot of the risk factors that people are interested in from a behavioral perspective can be thought of as emergent from the brain, and they can be considered along the pathways from socioeconomic status to brain to behavior, you know, to health. So I think it's in this way that you know, caring about the brain, caring about neuroscience, can contribute to a more complete mechanistic understanding of these pathways. And two related points. I don't know that we're quite there yet. I think we need a lot more work in this area. But one is, I think adding neuroscience evidence can oftentimes be used to better understand some of the preclinical ideology of disparities before, you know, disorders have kind of crossed the clinical horizon. So you might be able to see changes in the brain before you actually see, you know, a change or prevalence or an existence of a full-blown disease condition. So it might offer opportunities to kind of, you know, aid in risk stratification or prevention. Maybe, I don't know how, you know, quite yet, but I know we've been talking about this over meals. You know, maybe neuroscience evidence can sometimes help with policy justification. So if you can add, you know, evidence that risk factors and chronic illnesses are impacting the brain and you see these maybe early in life, maybe that kind of evidence can be, you know, more persuasive sometimes to legislators and people involved in policy making. So what can we do? What I hope might happen someday is I'd like to see more encouragement of neuroscientists to have a greater interest in health disparities. I think it would be great if there was some mechanism, like, you know, we're all here together today, if there were more opportunities like this to encourage disparities researchers to have a greater interest in neuroscience. I think that would be wonderful. And I think what we need to be doing is thinking about, you know, training grants and interdisciplinary opportunities for training for graduate students and postdocs who can speak multiple languages, you know, and understand the jargons of both fields. I think that these are important because disparities are not going away anytime soon. So these are life expectancy rates among Americans at age 25 by education level from 1981 to 2000. So this is having any college, and this is high school or less, 1981 all the way through 2000. And what you can see essentially is, you know, growing disparities that are expected to keep widening as inequalities continue to rise as well. So it's not like this problem is going away, I think, anytime soon. So I think in these regards, you know, there's a lot of room for neuroscience to kind of contribute to our mechanistic understanding of some of the, you know, the different pathways that are kind of considered along the way from disadvantage to disease. So I think I'm out of time. With that, I'd like to thank my colleagues and collaborators and students who have all done wonderful work to help make what I've talked about possible, and very grateful for the funding I've received over the years for this. So. Okay.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.